This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The idea is that you and I get briefed together on the important questions of the day by people who know what they're talking about. And if you love it or you hate it, please let us know what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. This week, we're looking at the latest developments in the saga of Brexit and whether the so-called Norway model might offer a way forward for Britain after it leaves the European Union. And if you enjoy this, you might want to listen back to other editions of The Briefing Room. Just type BBC Briefing Room into your favourite search engine. Tomorrow, there's another Brexit crunch meeting. But then, like someone walking down a thickly gravelled path, every single step seems to be a crunch. This gathering at Chequers will doubtless be guided by the Prime Minister's elaboration of her approach earlier this week.
There has been much sort of jocularity around the term Brexit means Brexit, but it does mean Brexit.
After 2 years, what Brexit means Brexit means is beginning to resolve itself into two or three clearer alternatives. And one that's being discussed a lot right now is known as the Norway option. Someone was prescient about this back in 2016, 6 months after the referendum.
I think we're going to finish up in the spring of 19, effectively with a Norwegian-type deal, which is not what the people of this country voted for.
Norway is not a member of the European Union, which ought to make trade between the two more difficult, but in fact, trade is pretty easy between Norway and the EU. How come? And what are the downsides? Step into the briefing room and all will be revealed. Apparently, the story of the so-called Norway option has its roots in the creation of two bodies, the EEA, the European Economic Area, and EFTA, the EFTA, the European Free Trade Association. Sorry, but there it is. To guide us through that maze is Catherine Barnard, Professor of European Union Law at the University of Cambridge.
EFTA is the European Free Trade Association. It's been around since 1960, which is when the treaty was first signed, but it's been a twinkle in the eyes of negotiators for some time.
Expanding trade boggles at tariffs, duties and the customs house. Hence the growing insistent demand for free trade in Europe.
Basically, the British were behind the idea of EFTA, and it was the then Paymaster General, Reginald Maudling, who was chairing the negotiations for EFTA. And the seven member states were Denmark, Norway, Portugal, Sweden, Switzerland, UK and Austria. There needed to be greater economic cooperation within Europe. And the question is, what form should that take? Should it take the form of a supranational organisation where there was pooling of resources, which eventually was the idea behind the European Union? Or should it be more intergovernmental, where states retained their sovereignty and cooperated at a political level? The UK favoured the latter. They favoured a much more intergovernmental model. They didn't like the closeness envisaged by the French and the Germans in what became the EEC treaty, which ultimately evolved into the EU treaties that we talk about now. The EFTA Convention was modelled on the GATT. The GATT is a General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which was signed in 1947, and that's now become the WTO, the World Trade Organization. The EFTA Convention was about primarily removal of restrictions on movement of goods, but it also had some provisions on free movement of persons. But it's quite clear that in the early days of EFTA, it was about removing tariffs, so customs duties, on goods as they crossed frontiers between the EFTA members. And actually, the EFTA states managed to remove tariffs on industrial products completely by 1966, which was 2 years ahead of the EU removing tariffs on the similar goods within the EU. During the 1960s and early 70s, there really wasn't much going on, but there were very little good relations between the EFTA states and the EU. But then, in 72, of course, the UK and Denmark and Ireland agreed to join the European Union, which meant they had to leave EFTA. So they join the European Economic Community. EFTA carries on, probably somewhat weakened because it's lost two rather large states, but had always wanted to work more closely with the EU, and the question was how it was going to do that. And it was actually Jacques Delors, the rather well-known president of the European Commission, who was there in the very late 80s, very early 1990s, and his idea was for some sort of European economic space, which eventually mutated into the European Economic Area. European Economic Area currently comprises three states, which are Iceland, Norway and Liechtenstein. Switzerland was also meant to be joining the EEA, but following a referendum, the Swiss voted against. And so those three states who are in the EEA are rather confusingly referred to as EEA EFTA states. I'm sorry for this spaghetti of acronyms, but that's where we're at. So the EEA is an agreement between the EEA EFTA states, that's Norway, Liechtenstein and Iceland, and the EU. And the idea is that the single market rules that apply within the EU are extended to the EEA. And that means that there will be free movement of goods, persons, services and capital, plus some of the so-called flanking policies like social policy, competition policy, state aids, all apply to the EEA states as well as to the EU states. So essentially it's expanding the remit of the single market.
Professor Catherine Barnard on the origin of Norway's almost unique relationship with the EU. But how does this relationship with the EU operate now? And could such an approach work for Britain? To explain all this, I'm joined now in the briefing room by Jon Erik Fossum, Professor at the Arena Centre for European Studies at the University of Oslo, and Liv Monica Stubholt, a former Deputy Foreign Minister, now a partner at the Norwegian law firm Selma, and an expert in EU-Norway relations. They're both in Oslo. Jon Erik Fossum, can you give us an outline of what the Norway model of relationship to the European Union is?
What is generally referred to as the Norway model is a relatively complex construct based on a total of 120 agreements. The core of this is the European Economic Agreement, which encompasses three states, Iceland, Norway and Liechtenstein. These are all members of EFTA, where also Switzerland is a member, but Switzerland voted down a membership in the European Economic Agreement. Now, what we call the EEA Agreement is actually a bridging agreement between EFTA and the European Union. You could call it a two-pillar structure with the EFTA states on one hand and the EU on the other. The point is that the EEA states did not want to rescind sovereignty when affiliating with the EU, and they have done that through the type of institutional structure that they have formulated. So this is the core economic aspect of it, encompassing the four freedoms of persons, capital, goods and services.
By persons, we call it freedom of movement, yeah.
Of course, freedom of movement. This agreement started out fairly narrowly in 1994 and has expanded because it's based on a dynamic form of adaptation to the EU, which means that anything that is relevant to the EEA will be included in the agreement through procedures where the Norwegian Parliament, when necessary, gives its sanction to this. But it means that the agreement expands, and it also expands in membership as the EU expands, so that it is currently now 31 members strong. So it's important to underline that the EEA agreement is actually 31 member, but it's based on the two pillars of EFTA on the one hand and the EU on the other hand.
Yes, yeah, so EFTA plus the EU makes the EEA and 31 members.
One, yes, because Switzerland is only part of EFTA, but it is affiliated through a somewhat different arrangement. Now, in addition to this, Norway, Iceland and Liechtenstein are also affiliated with the Schengen Agreement, which is the EU system of external border controls, and Dublin agreements, as well as also foreign and security policy.
What does that actually mean?
This might sound odd for a non-member to be so closely affiliated with something as sensitive as borders, but it has a very important political reason, namely that when Sweden and Finland joined the EU, for Norway the problem was that if it wanted to maintain the Nordic Passport Union and the free mobility within the Nordic region, it would face with either asking the EU to be affiliated with the Schengen Agreement or facing a close border with Sweden.
Let me interrupt a moment just to make sure that I understand this properly. Norway is a part of the Schengen area, which the UK currently isn't, in order to have the kind of relationship on the Swedish border that, let's say, UK would want after it leaves the EU with Ireland.
Indeed. That's the parallel.
So the logic of a Norwegian solution for Britain would be that it joins Schengen.
Yes. Well, I think the EU would accept the UK in its current situation, actually, without having to be a member of Schengen, even if it were affiliated with the EA, because, of course, what you are talking about in terms of a soft Brexit for the UK to be part of the internal market and the customs union doesn't necessarily presuppose membership of Schengen.
Are the Norwegian people happy with this relationship with the EU and the different components of Norwegian public opinion, businesses, general public and so on?
There has been a clear majority in favour of the EEA agreement since its inception, and a number of parties are staking their reputation on maintaining this agreement. It doesn't mean that people necessarily love it, but what it means is that this is the arrangement they have fallen down on and say that this is as far as we can deal with. This is the only way in which we can handle this very, very controversial EU membership issue, because the EU membership issue in the two referenda we had in 1972 and 1994, they were deeply divisive, both of them, in the population. And parties were split up, families were split up, regions were poised against each other. So this was a very, very controversial issue. So what the Norwegian political system has done is that they, with each coalition agreement, because we have coalition governments, there is an agreement, tacit or written, that they will maintain the status quo, which I call gag rules. So what the Norwegian political system has done in order to deal with this very controversial issue is that they have set the membership issue aside and then basically go on with EU adaptation. And that's how this whole arrangement has been depoliticized by the Norwegian political system. So people are living with the agreement. It is democratically problematic, clearly, but it has served Norway well in terms of having clear and predictable access.
Why is it democratically problematic? Do you mean because Norway has to embody rules made by somebody else, i.e. the EU?
Yeah, Norway does embody the rules and norms made by the EU. Of course, we have some type of access to the EU system. And what I understand from the Norwegian delegation in Brussels is that the EU system also listens to Norway.
Liv Monica Stubholt.
This is quite important in understanding the nature of the EEA, because it is being, I'd say, narrowly correctly described as a rule-taker system. However, it starts out with the initial point made just now, which is that we went for the EEA agreement because it allows us to retain our sovereignty. And that is really, as it appears to us, at the core of the UK discussions as well. So that means it's a multilateral treaty. There is no direct effect. There is no supranationality, meaning Brussels is not able to impose any rules on Norway unless it is adopted by the Norwegian Parliament. Now, the fact of the matter is that we do adopt the rules they bring to the table within the EEA doesn't take away the fact that constitutionally and legally, and therefore also politically, this is a reality. And I think that the rule-taker moniker is correct, but it has to be preceded by the understanding of retaining and for the UK regaining sovereignty.
Let me understand. This is a really important distinction that you're making here. What you're saying is, yes, in practice, Norway has to adopt most of the rules that the EU itself adopts, but it has to make the decision to do that, and consequently, formally, it retains sovereignty.
Yes, and I think that formality is it's clearly a legal reality, but I would call it a political reality as well, because you correctly say that we have to, but that is in quotation marks in the sense that we don't have to in any legal sense of the word. The Parliament can say no to any of the Brussels rules that are being put on the table via the EEA committee to the Norwegian Parliament. Yes, there would be implications, but it is in accordance with the multilateral agreement between the 31 countries to actually exercise that right.
Jon Erik, can you tell me about one other thing? How much does Norway actually pay into the European Union?
As far as the figures we have, it's around 800 million euros a year, basically. And half of this is EEA support, which is what they call solidarity support to the countries in Central and Eastern Europe. And half of this, more or less, is allocated to the various program areas that we are participating in. And in the latter case, we get a lot of this back. I mean, as a researcher, I know this because we apply for EU grants and we get grants and so on. And we are treated equally on a par with members in this. So that... it's difficult to say exactly what the net outflow is in a sense, but it's clear that we are benefiting tremendously from the type of networks and collaboration and so on we have.
Liv Monica.
If you look at this from the EU point of view, I think there are two points worth mentioning when the UK is considering its options. Firstly, one of the attractions of the Norway option is that it is very efficient for the European Union. It takes very little out of them to manage it. It is unbureaucratic, as it were, for the European Union and the Commission to manage the relationship to the three countries under the European Economic Area Agreement. That provides some leverage and some room for negotiation because it is not cumbersome for them.
Yeah, I agree with that. With the proviso that, of course, the Norway's relationship to the EU is based, as I said, on a kind of depoliticized arrangement, and it's based on a high level of trust. And of course, that means that people have to be rather reasonable in relating to each other. So it does depend on what type of issues are being raised to the EU as well. And Norwegians, in this sense, have proven to be very reasonable and a very good cooperation partner with the EU, which therefore has also been very accommodating and flexible.
Are you trying to suggest that Britain maybe not be quite so reasonable?
I think Britain is deeply divided, and there are some people that are more willing to be reasonable in relation to the EU than other people are.
Let's conclude this with talking about freedom of movement. It's been often said that one of the major aspects in the British referendum campaign was the question of control of borders and not maintaining freedom of movement. Can there be a British-Norwegian option which limits freedom of movement?
What is clear is that the present European Economic Area Agreement is based on free movement of persons as of capital goods and services. That being said, if you were prepared to accept things in principle, you would be able to look at how it would actually work. We know, firstly, that there are emergency provisions in the European Economic Area Agreement, not that different from what you have in the European Union, that would be available if there were extraordinary circumstances, could be invoked and exercised based on the decision by the country itself. Secondly, we've seen, haven't we, in the past, that there have been the option of capping the intake of new citizens that was applied to countries coming in to the European Union, where you had caps on how many the former East European countries could export, as it were, to the different older European Union member states. Could you imagine that you had exit provisions that were mirroring that type of system, allowing things to come down in the UK to get a grip on how you would like to do this in the future? So my basic answer would be you would have to accept the principle of free movement of persons to join the accession agreement that the European Economic Area Agreement is to the European Union. But if you did, I think you could do a lot with your very skilled diplomats.
leave Monica Stubholt there and Jon Erik Fossum. So hopefully now, if someone mentions the Norway option, you'll have some idea, even if they don't, what they're going on about. But how likely is it that we'll see something like the Norway option being implemented? And if not that, what? I'm joined now by Peter Spiegel, news editor at the Financial Times, and someone who's covered developments in Brussels for many years. Peter Spiegel, do you share the feeling that some people have that Norway, or a variation on Norway, is where the British Brexit discussion is beginning to end up?
I don't think the government will admit that, because frankly, Theresa May has already said that's a red line. We do not want to go to the Norway model. I think they'll go a little bit short of that. The Norway model is full single market membership. Customs union is one step before that. It allows Theresa May to say, we are not paying into the EU budget. We are not rule takers. I don't think politically, although I think, frankly, from an economic perspective, it would be the easiest and best solution at this point. I think politically, she can't go that far.
So I'm trying to understand this. You don't think, therefore, that what we call the Norway solution, in other words, effectively, membership of EFTA and therefore of the EEA, is something that we're going to end up going for?
I think the difficulty politically now is she has laid down her red lines. The red lines get moved and sometimes get violated. But in my view, the one that she really has stuck with is free movement of people, the migration issue, and paying into the EU and the European Court of Justice. If you are Norway, you have to do all those things. So I think that's a bridge too far for her. So I don't think this prime minister can do that.
Is it your reading that there are significant sections of business and of the Tory party who would nevertheless want to canvass this possibility?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you talk to any business leader, and this is the obvious solution. Particularly if you remember the UK economy, about 80% of it, particularly export, is services. A customs union only covers goods. So frankly, it's no good for Britain. What Britain does well is export services, financial services, other things like PR, these kinds of things that are not actual goods that Britain is very good at. If you are a single market participant, you can do those seamlessly in the EU. Customs union, you just can't do that. So you do have a lot of business leaders who are advocating for this. And the traditional pro-business bit of the Tory party also wants to do that. Those who care more about the damage done to British business and to the economy, I think would much more advocate for the Norway model.
And yet you think that Theresa May is stymied both by her past promises and the position of harder Brexiteers from taking that option.
Yeah. I mean, one of these sort of mind games we played, in some of our opinion discussions we have at the FT is, what if David Cameron hadn't resigned and had campaigned for, okay, Brexit, but we got the best Brexit we can, and didn't put the same red lines that Theresa May did? Cameron never said during the campaign that Norway was not an option. He argued why he thought it was not ideal, but he could have very easily come out and say, hey, look, I lost. It is my job now to get the best possible deal for Britain. Everything's on the table, no red lines. And I think if David Cameron perhaps had stayed prime minister, maybe we'd be going for the Norway model. But from day one, May has said these are the red lines, and I just think she cannot back down on this. And she's such in a weak position now that I think it's impossible.
But that also seems to suggest, does it not, that there could quite conceivably be a parliamentary majority only for something like the Norway model?
Yes, conceivably. I mean, the problem is you have to do the math, and the math is very difficult because you need some sort of rump bit of the Tory party plus some remainers in the Labour Party who are willing to reach out and support May even when her own rebels are against her. I do think it would take either a new leadership of the Tory party without an election or a new election for that to happen. I just don't think that Norway, under the weakened Theresa May right now with her slim majority in Parliament, she loses one Brexiter or five Brexiters, she's lost her majority in Parliament. I don't think it happens.
But Peter Spiegel, we've got to end up somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
And we've got to end up with some kind of deal. Now, people talk about how the Swiss model is Norway minus, or a Canada double plus model is Canada with some, a significant advantage, but with services thrown in and so on. If it's not going to be something like Norway, which at least has the advantage of pre-existing and everybody understands what it is, then what on earth exists around the world are we looking at?
Yeah, I mean, this is why I get back to this customs union, because I think it meets the political necessities that May has laid down and solves some of the trade friction issues, as they put it, that she's dealing with. So in customs union, again, you do have a free trade zone for goods. So not brilliant for the UK because it is a services-based economy, but at least you get some of these, you know, friction things that, that May has talked about. The negatives, besides the fact that services aren't included, is, you know, the Liam Fox argument that we're going to go around the world and start striking trade deals with the US and Australia and, you know, be the paragon of free trade. You can't do that in a customs union. In a customs union, the EU still sets trade policy. So that's why the checkers debate is, how do we do customs union but don't do customs union? And that's essentially what she's proposing. And she's tweaked it again this week, and we'll see how that goes down on Friday. But the EU has a customs union. And I think the reaction has been thus far, you either come into our customs union or you don't. Don't play this sort of second tier, you know, math on this with us, because we're not going
to
go for it.
So the EU is unlikely to get to it. But I'm bound to say that from the way you've described it, that the customs union, as proposed by Theresa May, has a set of completely unique disadvantages.
It does. It does.
And with this, almost none of the advantages of other solutions.
Yeah. I mean, again, this is where politics and economics just collide. And frankly, politics usually wins. From an economic and business and finance view of the world, Norway is the obvious solution. As you said, the advantages are, you know, the bits of the UK economy that the UK does best, gets the play ball in Europe, frictionless trade, seamless borders. But the political red lines of free movement of people, you can't do that politically. And she has already vowed that she will not go down the Norway route. And so she loses politically. So it makes economic sense, but is politically radioactive for her. The issue of parliamentary sovereignty matters a whole lot more in this country than it matters in any other European country, particularly Norway. You know, other countries get neuralgic about other things. But in Britain, it just seems to me the political culture is the sovereignty of parliament is a major, major issue that really activates a huge portion, particularly of the Tory party. So from the business point of view, the customs union solution is less good than Norway. But I think if you try to match what is the most she can get economically with the least political pain, I think you end up with customs union. And I think it's the only route. It also, in some ways, takes care of Northern Ireland. Because if you're in a customs union with the EU and the Republic of Ireland is also in a customs union, the border becomes not an issue. So that also, I think we can't leave out of the conversation. She needs a way to solve Ireland as well as everything else she's dealing with. And it just seems to me, when you just look at the path of least resistance, let's be honest, that's what politicians always do, that politically and economically, this customs union, not as good as Norway, but good enough that she can get sell it politically.
To the House of Commons, as it currently exists.
Well, look, we have seen Jacob Rees-Mogg and his committee there say that they can't support it. And this is why it's taken so long. I mean, we literally got 6 weeks left of negotiation, and she still hasn't had agreement, not only in her Brexit cabinet group, but in the broader cabinet. I mean, that's what Chequers is all about. The reason they can't agree on this is exactly the discussion we're having. There is an obvious economic solution, and those in the cabinet who believe in economics and are pro-business want to go that route, but you have the hardcore, and I use ideologue not in a pejorative sense, but they are ideologues. They believe that UK has to take back sovereignty, that Parliament has to regain sovereignty, that nothing else matters. We can disagree with that, but these are politicians of principle, I think, on both sides, who have diametrically different views on the world, and they're both in the same big tent of the Tory party, and she can't get agreement. And that's why we are here 6 weeks before the time she has to get a deal, and she still can't get her cabinet to agree. What she is hoping for is this newfangled customs arrangement.
Facilitated customs arrangement.
There we go. Fantastic. So I think what she's hoping is she gets this through the cabinet because it is a bit vague and it has offers a little bit for everything. And she's able to go to Brussels saying, here's our white paper. Let's start negotiations. You know, David Davis in The Telegraph today has rightly said Brussels has already rejected this. So the dynamics of this, to me, as a foreigner, I find this slightly bizarre. You're having a negotiation with yourself declaring victory when you haven't even started negotiating with the people you're supposed to be negotiating with, which is the EU. So it is right now, it is Britain talking to itself.
Peter Spiegel, and I hope we're all a little clearer now. My thanks to him, to Catherine Barnard, Jon Erik Fossum, and Liv Monica Stubholt. We'll be back next week. Until then, goodbye. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by Neil Koenig, Serena Tarling, and Olivia Beasley. And please let us know what you think about this programme, or indeed the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. And we really do appreciate hearing from you.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life,
and all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.